If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. There are several different tiers available, with perks to go along with each, including an exclusive monthly series available only on Patreon. Each episode will feature a different individual who has committed murder in the state of Texas. We'll outline their crime or crimes and let the listeners decide if they are responsible for others. We sincerely appreciate all donations as they help cover the cost associated with research and production. Thanks, y'all. We'd also like to ask that you stick around until the end of the episode for a promo of our friend's podcast, True Crime Story Time. Now on to the show.
The Gone Cold Podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
He thought that he might have some connection to that crime. He said he's talking about a girl being kidnapped in Texas, killed and everything. Well, some people, though, they get to a point where they just don't care. And they, you know, hey, I might as well confess to something like that, get put out of my misery or something.
Carla Walker's abduction and murder was not a crime motivated by robbery. Nothing of value was taken from her. Rodney was not held at gunpoint and stripped of his belongings. The perpetrator of this unjustifiable act wasn't simply motivated by the sexual assault against the innocent, beloved teenager. Some believe that the man who took Carla didn't intend to kill her, that the search efforts and media coverage was so massive, so intense, that by the time he realized his mistake, there was no way to get out of it unscathed without silencing her. The call to the Fort Worth Police Department after Carla's body was found, the intoxicated man confessing, "I didn't mean to kill her, I just wanted to fuck her," though indicative of a repentant, apologetic confession, the anonymity of the caller deems it to be taken otherwise, particularly with his choice of words. If the caller was even the killer at all. The phone calls to the Walker home that started just after the abduction and lasted for years after, and the carnation left in the urn on Carla's grave, could be interpreted as a sign of remorse or a sign of guilt. Perhaps thinking of the abduction in the following terms will cast doubt that the perpetrator of the crime ever intended on letting her go. A man approaches a car with a loaded .22 Ruger pistol. He opens the vehicle's door, proceeds to pull out a young, screaming, teenaged girl. Tells her date, "I'm going to kill you," before repeatedly hitting him on the head with the butt of his gun, putting the gun a few inches from his face and pulling the trigger 3 times, without knowing his gun would fail. He proceeds dragging a screaming girl across a parking lot with an apartment complex just across the road and houses also not far away. This man was possibly in the bowling alley that night, carefully examining young women or couples who might satiate his depraved appetite, when an unsuspecting young woman, Carla Walker, entered the establishment to use the restroom, then a quick makeout session, before returning to the Walker home. This man most likely followed her out to the parking lot, or possibly the man who preyed upon Carla had seen her somewhere else and stalked the couple there. However Carla's abduction went down, it seems most likely that the perpetrator was on the hunt. There have been a seemingly innumerable amount of persons of interest and suspects looked at for the abduction and murder of Carla Walker. Former chief deputy for the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office, Jim Minter, described police officers in the era of Carla Walker's murder as having, quote, a lot more leverage or freedom back then. They had ways of getting the information or the confession that they wanted. In 1974, Fort Worth and Tarrant County homicide detectives were tough as nails and had no qualms about demonstrating that fact in interrogations. To put it into perspective, Minter told us that Fort Worth homicide detective George Hudson and Tarrant County Sheriff's Office investigator Bobby Wessler were two officers he'd want by his side going into war. He said together they were an intense group of guys, a tough crew. Ostensibly, intimidation and physical coercion played a huge role in the investigation of Carla's murder. These detectives all worked Carla's case, and it should be noted that her case impacted these men well beyond retirement, as it was a case in which they dedicated every fiber of their beings. The polygraph or lie detector test also played a crucial role in the investigation. The suspects were cleared left and right using this technique, which is problematic to say the least. Most courts in the United States will not admit polygraph results into evidence, and there's a good reason for this. Proponents of polygraphs claim that the tests produce 90% accurate results, while those critical of the testing claim that number to be as low as 65, a number that virtually renders the results of the polygraph worthless. Even if the debate called for a compromise of averaging these two percentages, the polygraph remains questionable at the very least. Psychophysiologists say that the method of testing does measure physical reaction, but it is not unequivocally known how the nervous system reacts when a lie is told, and that fact becomes even more distorted when considering the variance of reaction from one person to another. Anxiety about taking a polygraph alone can produce false positives, which means a truthful individual can appear deceptive. Many psychologists believe, in fact, that the chances of this error arising are no more than 50-50, a coin toss. It's presumable, then, that a deceptive person could fool the polygraph easily, particularly one who is unremorseful or callous about the crime committed or is confident in their ability to trick the test. The polygraph was a top tactic used by the Fort Worth police in Tarrant County at the time of the investigation. It remains to this day a technique used often in investigations performed by law enforcement agencies around the country, even the FBI. The Friday before Carla's abduction, she and Rodney had attended a party, or beer bust as it was known, at Betty's Hole, a semi-secluded spot on Bembrook Lake. An older youth was hitting on Carla there, and Rodney had a non-physical confrontation with him as a result. He was brought in and questioned by police, who decided it was a dead end for reasons undisclosed. After interviewing a couple dozen young men, many from Western Hills High, and a few that police had handpicked at Carla's funeral, a possible suspect emerged. Shortly after Carla was abducted, patrolmen, who talked to several regular patrons and employees of the Ridgely Brunswick Bowl, came across a lead. The lead was in the form of a person of interest in Carla's then abduction. A 25-year-old man who frequented the bowling alley and was described by the interviewees as capable of perpetrating this crime and a drug pusher. Some added that they were very afraid of this individual. Patrolmen reported to homicide detectives that the man had recently cut his hair short and dressed in Western clothes, including cowboy hats, which fit the description that Rodney was able to provide. He stood 6 feet tall and had a slender build. The man also drove a light-colored vehicle. The night of Carla's violent abduction, the 25-year-old was bowling with another man. He frequented the establishment, but had not been seen there since that night. A composite sketch of the man was made, and the police began relentlessly searching for him. He was found and brought to police headquarters on Tuesday, February 19, 1974, the day before Carla was found. He was questioned and released after submitting to a lie detector test. It is unknown if any other factor helped rule him out as a person of interest. The identity of this man has never been released to the public. On Tuesday, February 26, 1974, almost a week after Carla's body was found, two men were arrested at their apartment in the 1700 block of Ashland Avenue in Fort Worth. The men, one a 24-year-old laborer said to fit the description of Carla's abductor, and the other a 26-year-old plumber, were picked up by narcotics officers and questioned about possible involvement in her slaying. The pair was arrested for distribution of hashish and marijuana, of which officers found a significant amount while searching the apartment they shared. The police doubted their involvement in Carla's kidnapping and cruel end, but found a few items in the search that they couldn't simply ignore, including a pair of gloves that had been, quote, stuffed in a suspicious place. After questioning, the young men were discounted. Rewards offered for information leading to the arrest of Carla's killer grew to a total of more than $10,500 by this point, a substantial sum for that time, one that would be about $52,000 today. Besides the money already collected by neighboring schools before her body was found, the Benbrook Mayor, the Fort Worth Bowling Proprietors Association, and many anonymous donors chipped in. One of these anonymous donors went only by the name of Dalton. This man set up a special phone line for any tips that could be given. A nervous and shaken man called his hotline, but ended the call abruptly before providing the information he claimed to have. Dalton pleaded with the caller to call back through the newspapers, but it never happened. The Fort Worth Press also received a letter from an anonymous individual that was never printed, though they placed a notice pleading with the writer to contact them again. The notice alluded that the mysterious letter contained hints of knowledge of the crime. Nothing was ever reported to have come from this. The next suspect that the police latched onto was a 35-year-old ex-convict from Sulphur Springs, Texas, about a month later. James Wendell Baxley, known also as Doc, was charged on May 29, 1974, in Dallas for the rape of a 21-year-old Irving, Texas housewife. After several hours of stalking the Irving neighborhood in which she lived, Baxley knocked on the woman's door and shoved his way in when she answered. He forced the woman's children to watch the sexual assault against their mother while telling her that he would kill them if she did not comply. Baxley didn't even begin to match the description of Carla's abductor provided by Rodney McCoy. He was 35 years old but looked closer to 40 and couldn't be mistaken for clean-cut in any way, shape, or form. He was a haggard-looking man, having already served one-third of his life in correctional facilities. Baxley was, however, released from the state penitentiary less than a month before the attack on Carla and had 9 prior convictions, including 4 for aggravated sexual assault. He was never charged for the crime against Carla. It is unknown how, exactly, he was cleared. Enter Tommy Ray Neeland. On April 23, 1974, a 16-year-old girl pulled her car to the side of Arlington-Bedford Road, just near Old Trinity River Bridge. She honked her horn twice to alert her younger brother and a friend, who were in the woods target practicing, that she had arrived to pick them up. The heavily wooded and somewhat secluded area was certainly off the beaten path, and it startled the girl when a man approached the vehicle asking if she needed any help. She declined, the man walked off, and she continued to wait. After a few minutes, and probably annoyed at her brother at this point, the teenager honked again, twice. The man who'd asked if she needed help returned, only this time he was armed with a 12-gauge shotgun. He forced her out of the car and walked her to his pickup truck. He forced her into the vehicle. He bound her hands with wire and placed tape, carpet tape specifically, over her mouth. He began driving. The girl was trying to say something to the man, but of course she couldn't. The man decided he'd loosen the tape to hear what she had to say, and as he attempted to, he veered off the road onto the shoulder. He stepped on the gas to get back on track, but the pickup's back tires just spun in their place. The vehicle had become stuck in the mud. The man freed the teenager, telling her, "I'll kill you if you tell the police." The young woman's mother called the police as soon as she heard the account. Though the man and his truck were gone when they arrived, the Arlington police stumbled upon a clue at the scene, a sanding disc that is commonly used by tile layers. It appeared the disc had been used to help free the vehicle from the mud. The police informed the press immediately of the man's description, and numerous tips poured in. Over the next few weeks, these tips, along with a quick check of flooring supply outlets in the vicinity, produced a name, Tommy Ray Neeland. 2 Tarrant County officers staked out the man's home. It wouldn't be long before police were able to take a photo of the man with a telephoto lens, show it to the victim of the attempted kidnapping, who confirmed, and obtained a warrant for his arrest. During observation, officers even got a glimpse of Neeland painting his truck in his garage, an attempt to conceal it. Tommy Ray Neeland was arrested on May 8, 1974, at 7 a.m., and subsequently charged with attempted kidnapping. His home was searched. 25 years old at the time, Neeland was a carpet layer. He was extremely well-kempt and happily married with 2 children. Also a Sunday school teacher and youth minister at Hurst Christian Church. Nealon was described as very enthusiastic in his faith of God. This attempt at kidnapping a 16-year-old girl shouldn't be minimalized as some sort of low-level crime, but Fort Worth police would soon understand the level of depravity which made up Nealon's true self. He would soon come clean about crimes that would cause law enforcement to wonder about his involvement in several other unsolved cases in the Fort Worth area. He confessed relatively quickly to the brutal murder of Kermit, Texas resident Nancy Mitchell on September 15, 1970, and the vicious murder of hitchhiking teenagers Mary Jane Handy and Robert Golson on July 1, 1972. Immediately following Nealon's arrest for the attempted kidnapping of the young woman in Arlington and these confessions, the police were interested in him for Carla Walker's abduction and murder. It took weeks to question him for that, since Nealon had just admitted to a crime far outside Tarrant County's jurisdiction. He had to be transported to Kermit, Texas, almost immediately upon his confession to the killing of Nancy Mitchell, to show police there how and where everything had taken place. When Fort Worth detectives were finally able to question him about Carla, he apparently knew much about the case, but only because he'd been keeping up with the papers, he claimed. Nealon failed one polygraph test, which included his denial of knowledge or involvement in Carla's abduction and death. He took two more that resulted in inconclusive findings. Rodney McCoy picked Nealon from a lineup that consisted of him and five police officers, though the identification was called shaky by police. Charlene Walker, Carla's mother, believed Nealon was not involved from the get-go. She was quoted in the Star-Telegram as saying, "We never did think he did it. I think there is someone in the west part of Fort Worth, near where we live, who did it, and who can clear it up." Two youths from Nealon's church provided an alibi for his whereabouts the weekend Carla was abducted. Tommy Ray Nealon was not charged in Carla Walker's murder. There are many differences in the nature of Nealon's known crimes and the abduction and murder of Carla Walker. So many, it seems, that it's hard to imagine why Fort Worth police were so sure it was him for any longer than just a fleeting moment. The police didn't find any evidence of Nealon ever owning a .22 Ruger pistol. Nealon isn't known to have worn a cowboy hat at any time. He stood noticeably short at 5'6" and had what was described as a beer belly at the time of Carla's abduction and murder. Nealon's wife at the time of his 1974 arrest reports that he worked weekdays at the time and was always home nights and weekends. Nealon savagely mutilated his victims, something that hadn't been done to Carla. A detail that has confounded us is that Nealon insisted that he raped his teenage female victim, Mary Jane Handy, though the highly respected Tarrant County Chief Medical Examiner, Felix Gwotes, found absolutely no signs of the sexual assault of the teenager. He would, however, not recant this seemingly false admission. He was tried and convicted for the July 1, 1972 murders of Mary Jane Handy and Robert Golson, receiving a life sentence for each. The jury convicted and sentenced him in less than 70 minutes. He was also eventually tried and convicted for the September 15, 1970 murder of Nancy Mitchell. Because her body was so badly decomposed, the medical examiner could not rule on a cause of death. Nealon also did not know which act had killed her. The Winkler County prosecutor decided to charge Nealon separately for each of the sadistic acts he admitted to performing on Nancy Mitchell: kidnapping, death by asphyxiation by piece of plastic, death by strangulation with a piece of plastic, death by injection of air into the right arm via hypodermic needle, death by stabbing and cutting with a knife, and death by burying alive. Nealon would also be tried for one count of a combination of all the acts contributing to the death of Nancy Mitchell. Upon a guilty verdict for most counts, the state asked the jury for a sentence of 276 years. The jury returned with a sentence of 550 years. Whatever combination of factors led police to discount Nealon for Carla Walker's murder back in the 70s would be justified when DNA technology would fail to provide a match between him and the material found on Carla Walker. In the middle of November 1975, The Walker family hadn't heard so much as a peep from homicide detectives working the case in over a year. The family's perseverance for finding Carla's killer hadn't waned, though. When a nude female body was found and identified in a crate in February 1977, the Fort Worth police thought that it might be connected to Carla's murder. The woman had been strangled and cut in half to fit inside a sealed wooden crate that bore Air Force markings and was lined with aluminum and newspapers and left at a dumping ground. Her body had been washed of blood after dismemberment. The woman was identified as Julianne Adams, a go-go dancer from the west side of Fort Worth. Her roommate, Rafael Macias, confessed to her murder almost immediately and was found to have had nothing to do with Carla's death. It had been almost 2 years since Nealon was presumably cleared as a suspect in Carla's murder, and no other serious persons of interest had been found. That changed at the beginning of November 1977. D. Underwood was an investigator for the Benbrook Police at the time.
See, to me, like maybe 2 years later, it was sometime later, at least later, I got promoted to a criminal investigator, and I was working evening one night, and I got a call from, I believe it was the sheriff's department, it was an investigator down in Tennessee or somewhere like that, who was wanting to get some information about that, but he had a guy, he thought that he might have some connection to that crime. He said he was talking about a girl being kidnapped in Texas, killed and everything. I didn't know enough about the total investigation because I know Fort Worth handled the abduction originally and then Tarrant County worked the kidnapping, so I just gave the numbers how to get a hold of both of them.
Jimmy Dean Sasser, originally from Paris, Texas, was 31 years old and had just confessed to Carla Walker's abduction and murder. Although many people had confessed in the years since the crime, for reasons that were, more often than not, extremely bizarre, no confessor had ever been considered legitimate before Sasser. 1977 was a particularly bad year for Sasser. He lost his second wife, couldn't hold down a steady, menial job as a gas station attendant. He began using drugs and alcohol even more than he already did. He was like a suspect plucked directly from the daydreams of a frustrated police department. He was described as loathing women, having a history of domestic violence, abnormal, a weirdo, a pillhead, a crybaby, a nut, a coward. He was also said to be beyond the reach of a polygraph machine. He'd been in and out of mental health facilities. A psychologist described him as being very capable of committing a crime, such as the one perpetrated against Carla. Sasser's uncle was quoted as saying he needs serious mental help. His mother even told reporters he needs to be put in an asylum. Sheriff Evans, pointing out that Sasser was indeed in Fort Worth when Carla was slain, said he knows a lot about the case, and some of what he knew wasn't released to the press. Evans said Sasser needs to be confined in a mental hospital or penitentiary. He needs to be taken out of society. The sheriff also said that Sasser was prone to blackouts. Sasser was living in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, that November. On the night of the 3rd, after drinking all day in different bars and snorting cocaine, Sasser walked into the town's sheriff's office and announced that he had committed an old murder in Fort Worth, Texas. 2 days later, he was in custody at the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office. Sasser was indicted by the Tarrant County Criminal District Court 1 grand jury for Carla's murder on January 31, 1978. There were several problems with Jimmy Dean Sasser's confession, however, and many doubted his guilt. Sasser never mentioned the sexual assault on Carla in his confession. Homicide detectives who had or were currently working the case reportedly had many laughs about the conspicuous inaccuracies and clueless omissions in his signed statement. Sasser's mother stated that one of his peculiarities was that, quote, every time he gets drunk, he comes in and goes to the phone and says he's calling the police to turn himself in. He's done that a lot of times before. A couple months later, just like that, in April of 1978, Jimmy Dean Sasser recanted his confession, saying that the whole debacle was an embarrassment to him. According to Sasser, he was drunk, doped up, feeling sorry for himself, and apathetic about spending the rest of his life in prison at the time of his confession. He said taking the rap for Carla's homicide just came to him out of the clear blue sky. If you have any information about the abduction and murder of Carla Walker, please contact the Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. If you're interested in learning more about the depraved and twisted acts of Tommy Ray Nealon, visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. For a small donation, you'll be able to hear our series highlighting Texas murderers, where we describe the crimes committed and let our listeners decide if the perpetrators are responsible for other unsolved homicides. Nealon is the subject of our first episode in the series, which includes an interview we conducted with his wife at the time of his murders and arrest. Also, check out cowtowncrime.com for a detailed account of Nealon's crimes and life. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, The Suspects Part 2, William Ted Wilhoit. We'd like to thank former Tarrant County Chief Deputy Jim Minter and former Benbrook Police Officer Dee Underwood for their contributions to this episode. And as always, we'd like to extend a huge thank you to the Walker family. If you would like to support the show, please subscribe, leave us a review on iTunes, or help spread the word about the show. You can subscribe and download Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, or virtually anywhere else you listen to podcasts. We can be contacted on Twitter or Facebook by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we post pictures about the case and discuss all things Texas true crime and beyond. We'd love it if you'd join us there. Thanks for listening, y'all.
I'm Casey.
And I'm Samantha.
And we're the hosts of True Crime Storytime, a podcast for all things true crime.
We will be bringing you fortnightly episodes covering everything from murder and mysteries, disappearances, theft and fraud,
abductions and kidnappings, and more importantly, trying to take a lesson away from each case, because every story has a message.